Think of the strangers at play in my mind. People I never met or have left far behind.
Seems so long since I've seen you. Must be 5 years, I guess. You don't look a day over 19, but then you never look a day less, my love. You never look a day less. Remember the nights on the island, Newcastle Ave on the grass. Jeff on stage with the tridents, talking about the past, my love. Talking about the past, my love. Back home, across the footbridge, moon in the river below. Wishing we didn't have to walk home, but the buses, they weren't slow enough. Buses, they weren't slow enough. Seems so long since I've been here. Must be 5 years, I guess. You don't look a day over 19, then you never look a day less, my love. You never look.
Andy Roberts, finishing up a set. 1973's Urban Cowboy. Richmond, name of the song. You'll find Richard Thompson on this record, as well as Neil Innes, other stars of the era. Opal, for that great, great, great Kendra Smith. All Souls, name of the track from early recordings. Before that, The Product from Alive Again, Almost Afraid of It, the song we heard. Rodelius from Grosses Wasser, we heard Avanti. Before that, Helden doing Mobius from Helden 2, Aletea. Smirsch, been reissued, 2-LP set called Cassette Pets. We heard Special Branch Agent. QRN did Very Loud Science. We heard Hirsch nicht auf Sofa, H-N-A-S, from Gegestande fallen zu Boden. And the track we heard, Paradies der Flotten Sunderinnen. Tall Dwarves, Albumen, name of the track from Stumpy, the record where they compose songs according to loops sent in by their fans, tape loops. High Llamas from 1997's Hawaii, Sparkle Up. Lena Horne and Gabor Szabo doing Everybody's Talking from their shared experience together. Alessandroni, open that set. Galleria di Immagini from Prisma Sonoro. That's all we heard. My name's Scott. Happy to be back with you. And see you next week. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU, East Orange, WMFU, Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org. Stay tuned. It's a sort of halfway repeat performance of an edition of Radio Free Culture. The episode that aired while we were off during a hurricane. Stay tuned.
We've all heard that technology is changing journalism.
These small quadcopters, octocopters, these devices are here now. And were it not for the federal drone ban, I think we'd be seeing a lot more of them flying around above our heads.
Well, I believe that live stream, advanced live stream, is the future. That's the humanity only chance we have.
There's always something to talk about, there's always something to uncover, there's always something to question, and there's always something to document. So it's been busy, just like it has been during Occupy.
We'll speak with renegade journalist Tim Poole, who got his start a year ago at Occupy Wall Street and has gone on to cover protests from Anaheim to Madrid. And he does it all solo. Goes by Timcast.
Okay, cool. You like Echo or some kind of artist with one name or something. I don't know.
For this show, we'll head to a protest in Union Square Park and learn about the technology, the ethics, the celebrity, and we'll meet all the live streamers. Stay with us.
It should be interesting. I think at this anti-police brutality march, we very well may see some police brutality.
Welcome to Radio Free Culture. I'm Andrea Salenzi, the Managing Director of the Free Music Archive at WFMU. For this show, I'm speaking with independent journalist Tim Pool. This show was originally broadcast on the night of Hurricane Sandy, when our transmitters went down, so you probably haven't heard it. You're going to hear a conversation I had with Tim from a rally in Union Square Park. He was there doing what he is now world famous for. He uses live streaming technology to cover protests from around the world, and his work with the Occupy Wall Street movement gave him all sorts of notoriety, including being featured in Time's Person of the Year.
Occupy Wall Street is famously criticized for lacking a clear message.
I am here. The whole street is blocked off. I have no way in. Holy sh**.
But when activist and journalist Timothy Poole arrived with his camera...
We're live now on Broadway.
...as police evicted protesters from Zuccotti Park on November 15th, that was about to change.
Here we go.
Well, the protesters here may be among the most watched in history thanks to a new breed of journalists covering what's going on in the street.
All right, so let's get more information on exactly what happened last night in Anaheim from somebody who was there.
We've actually got some independent journalists that covered it last night.
And his method demonstrated the power of a new kind of media.
I'm just outside on Broadway. Down with riot police.
One that helped reframe how mainstream news outlets view the Occupy movement and its message.
I want to thank everybody who's watching. This is history. This is really important.
And he did it all with a cell phone.
I met up with Tim at an anti-police brutality rally on the steps of Union Square Park.
Hey everyone, this is Tim Cass, and you're listening to WFMU.
Before we got started with our interview, we were walking around the crowd. And we were approached by a big guy with the face of a little boy. He's holding a plastic Guy Fox mask in one hand and a camcorder in the other, and he just has crumbs all over his mouth. He asked if he could film us and asked what website Tim's from.
TimCass.com.
Tim Cass? So, where do you find that?
TimCass.com.
I mean, how do I find you? Really, you have one website just about you?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I put out all my own content.
Really? You have your own? So you have your own? Really? I thought it would be like you'd probably be from an organization or something.
Technically, it's an organization.
The boy's baffled by the idea of an independent journalist. Tim has no interns, no producer, no editor, no boss, no underwriters, no memos from up top. He is a one-man band. The boy turns his camera to me.
I'm not sure. And you are from...
Sure, I'm with a radio show called Radio Free Culture at WFMU, and I've been interviewing Tim about his unique approach. You know what he does? He has a camera like yours, only it's in his phone, and he just live streams from protests all over the world.
Actually, a lot of people do that. I was at Occupy Wall Street, the anniversary, and there were like 5 to 10 people doing that. Well, I always wanted to do that, but I never thought I had to. I never felt I could ever do anything like that.
You can. This guy didn't go to journalism school.
Well, there are some people who are just gifted on certain things, like technology and stuff, so it's not out of the realm of possibility.
I build robots, too.
Yeah, you are a smart person.
The boy is one of many camera toters in attendance at this rally. One of the streamers is a man in half a chicken suit named Rocky. He does a 24-hour stream of his life using an iPad mounted to his chest. And it somehow connects to being vegan. I'm not sure.
Just go vegan. It's so simple.
Remember, it was just a year ago, on a fall day like this one, that a lot of this very crowd was huddled in Zuccotti Park together. That's when Tim went from being a guy in the crowd to an internationally known broadcaster.
So I came down to Occupy Wall Street just to understand, you know, that my thing is observation. It's always been. And I was just filming with my cell phone and taking pictures with my cell phone. And then once I discovered I could actually do a live broadcast from my cell phone, I started doing that.
So do you think of that as an important moment where you crossed over in some way?
I guess into the public light. You know, when I was documenting before, it wasn't really for anything but myself, in the sense that I would watch it later. And then when I started live streaming, it became about, essentially it was still the same thing. I was streaming mostly because my footage would be harder to delete if taken from me. And when people just started watching, it became a live report. I became a journalist right there.
So then what do you feel like makes you a journalist? Like, do you have principles of journalism that you follow? Is there an ethical code that you've created for yourself around this practice?
Well, I just, you know, I have my own personal morals. Everyone's morals are subjective, but we mostly agree on a lot of similar ones. And it's a funny issue. You know, my thing is about just showing what's happening. You know, I'm not here with either group on here. I'm not a protester. I'm not a politician. I'm not a police officer. I'm not, you know, running security for an event. I'm not organizing an event. I'm just here with a camera. And if you want to know what's happening, I'll do my best to just tell you. But the funny thing is, you know, people often question the ethics or the professionalism of independent journalists and especially citizen journalists. When you have pundits and you've got reporters for these big outlets who are so obviously biased, and these anchors, obviously biased, and they have the nerve to call other journalists unprofessional or lacking principles and lacking ethics, and that just makes me throw up in my mouth a little bit.
So from Occupy Wall Street, that's when you kind of became this idea of Timcast, and then from there you went on to some other protests where you brought the same practice of live streaming what was going on. Tell us about some of those events and some notable moments there.
The Trayvon Martin rally was particularly significant. So everyone's familiar with that story. And down in New York, in Union Square, this was probably the first major event that was outside the... I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say it was political. It was over... Well, it's hard to say. It's hard to define exactly what the rally was about. Awareness for essentially the racism that's in our systems and justice being sought for the Trayvon Martin in this case, whatever your take on the issue might be. So that was a big shift. It was a very emotional, raw protest that wasn't necessarily seeking political change, but more about cultural change. That was really interesting. There was also the riots in Anaheim that I had been at. And this, again, was in response to a teenager who was shot by a police officer. And the community came out in this powerful, you know, raw emotion, got into a, you know, I guess started to riot. The police came in force with riot weapons, which created this escalation between the community and the police. So the locals started gathering around in response to seeing these officers everywhere. And then started throwing rocks, and the police started firing at them with riot weapons, and it just... I myself ended up getting shot at by police, and that was probably the most memorable instance for me.
Where do you see yourself falling when you're in that moment where you're live streaming from these protests? Are you on the side of the protester? Are you on the side of the police? How do you strike a balance? Like, what are you after in that moment to tell the world about?
I'm not on anyone's side. I mean, everyone thinks they're the center of the universe. Everyone thinks they have the right answer to all of our problems. I don't think either of those things. I think if anyone is going to find what the answers are, they first need the data to be as clean as possible. So when it comes to a big protest event, I'm not going to yell and protest and say, here's the way to save the world. And I'm not going to, I mean, honestly, the police feel the same way. They think they're saving the world. I want to try and show everyone exactly what happens so that they can analyze that data. They can take it in and say, you know what? We know what happened. Here's the right way to change, you know. The decision's not going to come from me as to how to fix the problem, but I will help in transferring the data to those people.
What does live streaming offer that other ways of documenting an event can't possibly give you?
There's something about watching in real time that creates an interest. You don't know what's going to happen, so you're compelled to watch. And this interest is really good because, you know, if nothing happens, if you have your standard video and you know nothing's going to happen, and someone tells you you're going to watch for 15 minutes and nothing's going to happen, they're not going to watch it. They're not going to know what happened, regardless of, you know, how significant or insignificant it was. But when it's live, you have no idea, and you have to know. But more importantly, with these individual channels in live streaming and these videos that can be online, I can broadcast for hours on end. You know, my longest was 21 hours, but frequently major events I'll do 14 to 15 hours of live broadcasting. It's totally typical. What this does is it allows people who are interested in watching the events unfold throughout the entire day, they're able to do that. In the old media form, you might get maybe 3 or 4 minutes of live coverage from the event before the network switches to a different story.
Why do you think you're the only guy with the camera doing this in a lot of these situations?
Well, first of all, I'm not the only one, but I would say there are only a handful of live streamers who consider themselves to be independent and who consider themselves to be actual journalists who are, you know, pushing the envelope. These, you know, I've talked to news crews, I've talked to CBS, I've talked to NBC, and aside from the fact that they're far behind in the technology, when they do finally realize, okay, so there is something we can do with cellular data and live streaming over the internet, they get these big, you know, these big companies and consultants who then sell them $60,000 rigs that are totally unnecessary. And they're walking around with this big bulky setup and they think, hey, look at me, you know, I'm streaming. And then they look at me and I'm carrying a cell phone with, you know, 4G LTE. And we literally will have the same bit rate. So, you know, there are benefits to having a rig that has 16 modems and costs $60,000, but it's definitely not worth $60,000.
What is in your toolkit?
Well, a year ago, it was much different from what I'm doing today. So I have different tiers, I suppose. The first and foremost is literally just a cell phone and a battery. And the batteries are about a pound, so I can carry a tiny bag, a little travel bag, and it carries everything I need to do a live broadcast. As for right now, I actually have an entire production studio in my bag. I've got a DSLR camera, I've got a lavalier mic, I've got a shotgun mic, I've got many different phones to access different networks and also gain access to cellular networks around the world. And I've got a solid-state computer, so I can do the video editing on the spot as well. I've hard drives, everything. And the bag is probably about 25 to 30 pounds.
Wow, you're prepared. We're here for Radio Free Culture talking in Union Square Park. Why are we here today?
There is a rally happening right now. It's the 17th annual anti-police brutality rally in March. It happens every year, and here we are.
So what's your approach when you come to a rally like this?
It's pretty simple. Observe, try and take as much in as possible. I'll look for people who seem to be organizing and people who seem to be watching, and I'll talk to them a bit about what's going on and what they think is going to happen. And then when I start feeling the energy rising, when it seems like the event is about to kick on, I'll announce via Twitter that I'm going to go live, and then I start broadcasting.
How many people do you reach when you announce that you're going live?
It entirely depends. I have no idea. I mean, on Twitter, I have just about 26,000 followers, but based on analytics and other services, I potentially reach 50,000. And during a typical broadcast at a major event, I'll have at any given moment around 5,000 people watching, and around 150,000 for the entire report.
Who do you think, who is that audience? You know, who wants to watch your stream from the comfort of their room or newsroom?
It's all different people. It's everybody. It's people who are online who see the link and are interested. Some people don't necessarily even know what it's about, and they might be compelled to keep watching. And some people know exactly what I'm doing and are hell-bent on making sure they don't miss a beat.
I love being in Union Square Park, and one of my favorite memories of being here is it was election night 4 years ago, and I was here with my colleague Benjamin Walker, and we were hearing the news up on, there was like a big screen right over there where you could see the results coming in, and everyone was kind of freaking out. There was a giant American flag people were throwing up, and it was my job to photograph the event for the public radio station where I worked. But every time I took a photo, or maybe like about 100 photos, I'd have to sit down, connect to the Union Square Wi-Fi, and then upload, and it was like the slowest thing in the world, and I just felt like, oh, there's got to be a better way to do this. So I love hearing about live streaming. But something else this makes me think of is that moment where you are the one documenting, and you feel this responsibility, like it makes you feel like more observant and more alive than you do all the other days. What's that like for you to be a live stream, to be the storyteller in every moment that you're going through for 14 hours?
It's like my brain shuts down. You know, when the march starts, when the event kicks in, if it's a conference and I'm live tweeting or shooting photos, then everything else sort of disappears. And literally the event is my sole focus. I can't think of anything else at the time, you know?
Is it exhausting?
Actually, No, it's strange. I get doing other events make me tired much more quickly than being out here. I mean, the day I did 21 hours straight, I actually hadn't slept for 2 days. And I, you know, aside from obviously being a bit malnourished throughout the day and getting cramps, totally able to keep going. In fact, the only reason I stopped was because everything seemed to have calmed down. And, you know, if it didn't, I would have kept going.
Do you feel like this is the work that you were meant to discover in your life? Like, do you feel like everything about your skill set has drawn you here, or do you see this evolving further?
That's a good question. I've had a lot of jobs where I felt like, wow, everything I've learned has led me here. I wonder if, you know, everyone sort of feels that way at some point. So for all I know, it could lead me here where I'm at, and I can take this and do something with it. Or this might just be another stepping stone to something even greater.
What do you hear from other people about the work you're doing? Like, what have you heard from other journalists? What feedback has been most memorable to you?
Everyone seems to tell me that I'm in this great place, and that makes me really happy. And I get a lot of support from a lot of really respectable journalists and people who work in the field, and that really helps keep me going. But at the same time, what I do doesn't pay the bills, and that's when it gets hard, and I'm thinking, okay, so, you know, everyone seems to appreciate what I'm doing, and they tell me that you keep going, you can do it. Meanwhile, I'm like, yeah, that's really great that you, like, support it and everything, and when I get a steady income from this, I'll agree with you a bit more.
Don't some people disagree with what you're doing and caution you against it?
The people who disagree with what I'm doing are the people who want to control information, I've found. You know, I was attacked several times during protests, and it's typically by protesters. It's pretty interesting. I've never been arrested, and people question me for not being arrested, and the protesters are like, oh, he must be a cop or something. Because journalists get arrested all the time. They do. And when it comes to the politics of an event, I found that a lot of people want to control their flow of information to make sure that they have the power to send a certain message. And they don't like it when an impartial observer comes in and tells people what's really going on.
Have you been arrested in your capacity as a journalist?
I've never been arrested, but I've been roughed up a bit by cops.
Specifically, what happened?
Oh, man, several incidents. I mean, we've had police officers in Chicago surround our car at gunpoint and pull us out, interrogate us. They took credit card numbers. Horrible, traumatizing event. I've had...
I think I saw that on the news.
Yeah, that was on the news.
With exclusive details in our ear to the underground is NBC5's Lisa Parker. Lisa?
Thanks, Stefan. All night last night, we heard from dozens of protesters and independent journalists about raids and traffic stops taking place across the city. Now, that kind of allegation is hard for us to confirm unless or until we see the kind of video that came into us from around 2 this morning.
We're being raided right now. For those that are watching, we are being raided by the CPD as we speak.
What is this for, officers? What is this for?
I'm unbuckling my seatbelt.
Gonna unlock it?
We're just pulled over. Stop, license. They didn't give us an explanation to why they're stopping us. You're watching us live
cars,
right now.
12 cars.
I've had cops grab me and sprain my wrist, throw me. I've been shoved and grabbed and, you know, every which way. I've been whacked a few times with batons, but I've been close to arrest. Haven't been arrested.
So we're here at this anti-brutality rally right now. Like, do you feel like a political leaning that aligns you with the protest we're about to see, the march?
Not political. I think, you know, politics, it's when people argue about the economy and healthcare, and some people say this is the right way to fix the economy and this is the right way to fix healthcare. But sometimes they are just facts. So is it a fact that many officers break the rules and are not held accountable? Yes, that is a fact. Does that mean that I am holding a personal vendetta against the entire police force or police everywhere? Absolutely not. So, I wouldn't participate in an anti-police anything, but I will be the first one to recognize that all too often, authority figures of all types, not just police officers, are not held accountable for the crimes they commit.
When I was a public radio journalist, I couldn't even walk through Occupy Wall Street without risking losing my job. When, in your capacity as the person documenting the protest, do you sometimes feel like you're being looped in with the protesters?
Yeah, and it's funny because people seem to, these I guess, mainstream journalists, they don't go and get the story anymore. And I wasn't alive 100 years ago, so I don't know exactly what they used to do, but it was my understanding that if you want to tell the story and you want to know what's going on, you have to be in there and you have to be talking to people. You can't stand outside, point a camera at it, and say, well, here we are looking at a group of people. They look pissed.
I'm here in Union Square Park with Tim Pool. He is the future of journalism, say many, who is featured in Time's Person of the Year. We've all seen him in Spin, GQ, and The New Yorker. The work he's doing people find really interesting. Why do you think this kind of live streaming media is striking a chord in this media landscape?
It's a combination of things. The first is the new technology, the low cost, and the ease of access. I essentially can go out, and I should say I actually have broadcast global events, international events, using nothing but a cell phone to hundreds of thousands of people.
So at this weekend's Radio Vision Festival, you pulled out a really cool piece of technology that the whole room was drooling at. It was your own personal drone. Tell us about that device and how you've utilized it in the field.
So this goes along with another part of my personal goals, and that's making journalism easier to access. So a friend of mine, Jeff Shively, we began working on a drone so that we could make a very cheap and effective way to get live coverage for any event, be it a fire, a flood, or a protest. We took a drone that you can buy at Brookstone at any store. It's called the AR Drone Parrot, and we did a little bit of hacking, and we set it up so that it can broadcast live over the internet. The idea being that helicopters and aerial coverage is very expensive, and you'll rely on a major organization to get that that coverage. But now, hopefully with the work we're doing, and as soon as the federal drone ban is lifted, we can create a plan so that any journalist can easily spend a couple $100 and film, get live aerial coverage from wherever they may be.
There's a federal drone ban?
Yes, there is. Until 2015, Barack Obama has stated that he wants the FAA to open up the skies by 2015. And then we're going to start seeing, it's going to get interesting. I mean, drone technology, I should first clarify that people assume drones are these big airplanes with guns, but drone generally refers to remote control aerial. Technically, it could even be a ground device. But these small quadcopters, octocopters, these devices are here now. And were it not for the federal drone ban, I think we'd be seeing a lot more of them flying around above our heads. So come 2015, they'll be everywhere.
And they'll deliver our tacos, right?
That's the big story, the taco copter, but I don't think so. That would be too heavy. So unless you've got a $20,000 drone, you're looking at a fly time of maybe a half an hour. And it's going to be able to carry maybe a taco, maybe two. But I think more importantly is that I think we're going to see drones right off the bat. The first and most obvious thing is currying papers, legal documents. You could easily launch a drone out your window. It'll fly and land and dock and recharge and hand your legal documents to your partner company, things like that.
So could you talk about an incident where a time that you've used the drone and captured something you felt like you couldn't have otherwise captured?
After it was set up, I brought it to Foley Square during an immigration rally, and I flew it up in the air to get aerial coverage of the crowd for better crowd estimates and just for, you know, aerial coverage for what it's worth. The police seemed confused, but ultimately didn't seem to care and ended up leaving. And, you know, I think aerial coverage has its benefits in some cases, but it's not as widely beneficial. You know, you're not going to use it everywhere. So the idea of making it cheaper, it's the whole point. You're not going to make a huge investment in something you're not going to use that often. So, anyway.
But, like, crowd estimates. I feel like I'm always seeing the report, which is the crowd was estimated to be, the protest was this big. No, it was this big. No, it was this big. Your numbers are wrong. So I like that idea that it could be an easy tool to have a closer answer.
Crowd estimates are the easiest way to identify bias. during the Madrid protests, I was down there, and I climbed up on the press scaffold, and it looked like, you know, it's really hard to estimate these crowds, but it could have been 30 to 50,000 people, and the Spanish government said 6,000. I can guarantee it was not 6,000 people. Certainly more than that. But the protesters said it was 100,000. So if you want to identify bias, just look at the numbers they're giving out.
So when you go out to a protest like the protest in Madrid, what's your process? Where do you begin? Where do you consider your work most valuable? And then how do you optimize participation in the media you're creating and engagement with it?
Engaging people is a grind. It is difficult, but there is a benefit in that I generally cover things that are interesting to people, and I cover them because they're interesting to me. When I, you know, say Spain, for instance, I'll use Spain and Canada as the Montreal as the examples. I first made contact with people who are familiar with the protests, and I hang out with them and get the general idea of what's going on, what the focus is, and I'll talk to some of the protesters and I'll talk to some of the locals, and then I'll go down and start of the event, and I'll watch and I'll observe. I'll try to talk to some people who seem to be in some kind of organizing capacity, and just individuals who are attending and walking by, so I can get an idea of how's everyone feeling. And then I turn the camera on. I'll tweet out that I'm live if I'm going live, and that's, you know, pretty much it.
Wait, so when you walk up to people and you start to get a feel for what the story is, how do you identify yourself?
I really don't. I mean, it's just a, hey, how's it going? My name's Tim. What's going on?
And they say, who are you with?
Sometimes. Protesters, particularly in the U.S., tend to be really defensive. And they start yelling at, you know, depending on what you ask, they'll yell at you that you're with Fox News or something. If I ask a protester if they saw who threw that bottle, they'll be like, who are you with, Fox News? And I'm like, no, there was a guy who threw a bottle. And I was asking, like, is he a part of the protest or... Like, people will be... I'll use a specific example of what I'm talking about. Someone threw a bottle, and he was accused of being a provocateur. So I was trying to see if he actually was a random individual no one knew, a bystander, or was he actually part of the rally, and was he there, and nobody wants to tell you.
And then on the other side, when an officer says, you can't be here, and then you say, I'm a journalist, and they say, who with, how do you handle that situation?
Well, I don't do that. I don't engage police. It's a huge mistake. If you want to get the story from the police officers, in the U.S., you're going to be hard-pressed to do so. They won't talk to you. Some police officers in some cities will. If an officer tells me I can't be here, first of all, I won't make eye contact with them because that's how journalists get arrested. I won't challenge a police officer because that's how journalists get arrested. I will move out of the line of sight of that police officer and stay away from them.
Who taught you how journalists get arrested? Where did you learn that?
Well, I've been skateboarding my whole life, and I've learned to choose your battles. If a police officer tells you not to do something, if you try to fight him on it, you are most likely going to lose until it can go to the courts, because our society will side with the officers in the beginning. But a lot of the instances of arrest... Wow, there's an ambulance. The police in New York, they do whatever they want. And we know this is true. We've seen the reports, heard the reports from NPR and the New York Times. The NYPD sends people down to New Orleans. They really act in... It's pretty ridiculous. So I've seen journalists down here. I've seen a lot of the arrests be random, arbitrary. But I've also seen journalists yell that I'm a journalist and you can't tell me what to do. And the officer says I can do... You know, they pretty much have the I'll do whatever I want mentality. And they'll just... It's pretty bad with the NYPD.
I saw a piece where you dispelled a myth that officers were covering their badges. Tell me about that situation, and how did you work between the two groups?
So in Times Square, the protesters were yelling that the police were covering their badges, and it wasn't true. I turned around and I said, okay, that sounds interesting. Let's check this out. The officers are wearing black bands around their badges that don't cover the number or their name, but they wear these to signify their respect for a fallen officer. And so I asked an officer, what is the black band for? And he said, have some respect, it's for a fallen officer. And I said, thank you. And then I quickly clarified to the viewers that they are, in fact, not covering their badges. And sure enough, that didn't translate to the protesters who still believed they were covering their badges. They could have walked 5 feet and found out it wasn't true, but...
Do you remember your first protest that you ever went to, just as Tim?
Yeah, I think I was This was the anti-war protests, I think 2003 in Chicago.
Do you remember that feeling that you get when you're like part of the protest and you're like, oh, don't go to Iraq. Oh, I feel this so strongly. Did you used to have that feeling and do you still have it sometimes?
I never had that feeling. I went down to this protest and I was a bit disgusted by what these people were saying. You know, there was no direct action. The people were essentially, you know, to be a bit of a pessimist, walking around in circles, expressing their opinions. And I thought there's got to be a more direct way. I understand the awareness, building up, you know, letting people know there's pressure and everything. And that's, you know, if they're going to do it, that's fine. But for me, I just couldn't stand being there thinking, what system can I be building that will create, you know, a change? Because I would check out so many protests and I would talk to so many people. And it seemed like most of the time they would go out, they would say what they want to say, and then at the end of the day, they were no closer to where they wanted to be.
That's so, you know, what's kind of interesting is like you're documenting this kind of group think that can happen and this kind of group movement that takes place and almost protecting the group in the work that you do, but you do it so alone. And it's interesting to me, why do you do what you do?
I do what I do because it's just a passion. It's just natural. I feel like the solution to our problems lies in having an understanding of the problems. So to just go, you know, for the reason I'm not going to get involved in politics, I'm not going to yell what I want, is that I don't have all the answers. In fact, I don't have all the data. So I can't say, here's the right way to run an economy, because I have no experience running an economy. But what I can do is I can do my best to provide clear data so that other people can watch and say, based on what happened here, we can make a prediction about what will happen here. And then we can start looking for the real answers to our problems.
Do you ever wish that you had other people to work with in what you do? I mean, you go by the Twitter handle TimCast. If you want to subscribe to Tim's YouTube channel, you head to youtube.com/TimCasts. That's plural if you can't hear my S's. And subscribe there. But it's about Tim. And it's a one-man show, right? You're a one-man band. Would you like colleagues? Would you like an editor? How would you feel about working in a team? How would that change your work?
I could definitely use a producer and an intern. So it's really difficult to balance doing all the research and then going out to the events. I can do it all. But I feel like it'd be much easier to delegate the responsibilities. Having a producer would be great, someone who could point me in the direction of where an event might be happening. But the editing will strictly, you know, come from what I'm producing. It would be awesome to have someone helping me out with upcoming events and making those phone calls to letting other press organizations know that my coverage is available for use. That's what I need. I need that.
What's your advice to budding young journalists, people who say, I want to be a Bobcast? How should people get started?
Just go do it. Mm-hmm. Find something you're interested in and go there and observe and document it any way that you can, and then share that. So, you know, one thing that's really important, I see this a lot, I've seen some of the people who are trying to stream get mad that they don't have viewers, and I've seen one person tweet out, why isn't anybody watching my channel, like, watch here. And then I get flack from people because I do have viewers, but when I first started doing this, I didn't have 5,000 people watching. I had two. And I was just, I want to do this. This is something I want to do. And the audience followed. So that I appreciate. You know, it's with hard work, and you pay your dues, you do the grind. And if you're good at it, if it's meant to be, then it comes.
What do you do to work on your own subscriber count? Like, how do you nurture a community around your own journalism?
It's just a grind, really. It's about producing good content, and it's about using social media to get the message out. I don't have a big marketing budget. You know, there's a lot of companies that, in fact, a company could easily hire someone to do what I do and then drop 50 grand in marketing and easily overtake, you know, what I'm able to produce. So I don't have access to that kind of stuff. So it's really about word of mouth, social media virility.
What's your relationship like with old traditional media? Like, how do you feel like they could utilize the work you're doing, and what do you feel like they can offer you?
I don't know what they could offer me. I mean, the widest coverage I've gotten is because the mainstream outlets picked up my live stream and hosted it on their websites. So Al Jazeera English put it up, Time.com put it up, you know, Reuters, New York Times, they all use my live coverage on many occasions.
And you were paid handsomely for this?
No, not paid at all. And but it is funny because they certainly were. You know, the hits driven to their website, you know, ad revenue and such. But it there's a balance. You know, when people say you get exposure versus getting paid, I certainly am grateful that the organizations used my coverage in the way they did, because it allowed me to essentially build an audience and build people who are interested. I could gain visibility that I really did need to continue doing what I'm doing. Now, in order to keep doing that, there needs to be more partnerships with more organizations that could use what I'm doing.
At a protest, there's often a bazillion cameras all clicking at the same time, lots of people tweeting, lots of people can kind of do the work you do, but there's something specific to live streaming. What are the challenges of live streaming media that make it unique for you? What makes for an interesting live stream, and how have you honed your craft to make that good?
I think I was a natural, really. I mean, when I first started doing this, I started with, you know, 2 viewers, and then 10, then 50, then 70, then 200. And what people tell me is that I just drive a compelling narrative. Even when nothing's happening, you know, my commentary is interesting. People, you know, I'm very informative, I suppose, and I give great background on the history of the events and things like that.
What are other imagined uses you see for live streaming? How could it be put to better use?
I think, and I hope, that at some point everyone will have some kind of streaming feature enabled on their device. You know, not too long ago, when there was the shooting in Wisconsin happened, there was a young woman who was tweeting from inside a mall during the incident, and journalists saw that and used her as a on the ground source of what was happening. Now, if she had some kind of streaming function on her phone, she could have become a live reporter and told the world exactly what was going on.
So you feel like this is a tool that anyone should be able to use?
It's the same as recording, except, you know, it goes out to the internet. When already people film almost everything with their phones when an event happens. So it's not really that much of a difference to, instead of just recording it, to broadcast it.
Is there a world where you could imagine live streaming being abused in some dystopian future?
You say dystopian future? I don't think we need to say anything like that, because technology is neutral, and it just depends on who's using it. In Charlotte, we saw the police using live streaming. They had the large live streaming backpacks, which makes me laugh because I feel like they're totally obsolete already. But the police are using it as well. It's a tool, and it's going to be used by anybody, whatever their side may be.
Well, we've been speaking with Radio Free Culture here on WFMU. I'm Andreas Lindsay, Managing Director of the Free Music Archive, with Tim Poole. And we're going to just walk over now and check out this protest that's been going on. Could you describe the scene a little for listeners who aren't here?
Well, right now there's a couple hundred people here at Union Square. Some people are singing and playing music. We've got an anti-police brutality rally going on. There's seems like a small police presence, some vans, some interceptors, as well as barricades. So, pretty calm for now.
What are things that you see when you look at the scene that the average person might not?
I don't know. The National Lawyers Guild lawyers, I see them right away and figure out where they're at. Who's holding a sign? Who's an obvious protester? Who might be a bystander who is just passing through? How many cameras are in the crowd? And police numbers.
When you look at the officers, are you able to identify?
Let's go over there.
Yeah, let's go.
Yeah, I know them all.
You know them all?
I know the supervisors. Everyone does. You got Sorensen, you got Lombardo, Diadamo, Winsky. Winsky's famous. Winsky's real famous.
How did you come to learn this? Just from your time at Occupy Wall Street?
Who the officers are? Oh, yeah, you see him so often. Then there's Rick. He's the hipster cop, and he's famous as well. He's actually, I think he's done an interview in GQ.
What makes him a hipster cop?
He dresses very, very well. He wears, you know, Ralph Lauren and these fancy clothes, and he has these thick black frame glasses. He looks like a hipster, and they call him hipster cop. So there's a lot, these supervisors, they're here all the time. There's I think that guy's name is Timoney, and there's Sorensen right there on the left. I can give them all I could give them all a professional review and rank them on their performance based on the year of coverage I've done at these events in New York. When I'm recording, if I need to look at police, I'll look through my camera. When you make eye contact with someone, you've officially like engaged. And the thing about police is all too often it seems like they're looking for someone to get into it with. You know, for whatever reason, they're in that emotional state. And if you look them in the eyes, they're now looking at you, and they're going to decide what they're going to do with you. If you stay off their radar and stay out of their way, then you can continue doing what you need to do without being impeded.
We spoke before, and you talked about moments that you've experienced police brutality. You've been shot at, you've been hit with a nightstick, things like that. How do you not attend a rally like this and feel something?
It's just about, you know, trying to understand why these things happen. Now, are these officers who are hitting me sadistic and like trying to beat me? Not necessarily. They're probably at work. They don't want to be at work. They want to go home. They want to go home and drink a beer and watch the game. And now here they are, and there's a bunch of people who are yelling and won't move. So they start hitting people. And it's not about I'm not going to get mad at, you know, another human being for being a human being. Do I recognize that there's a problem in the way humans react emotionally as opposed to logically? Of course. But getting mad about it and yelling at police officers and yelling at protesters is not going to solve the problem. In order to solve the problem, I have to keep my head cool and recognize this is happening for this reason. And just, that's it. You know, it's interesting to see personal bias from people. Without investigation, you'll have some people defend police officers. And without investigation, you'll have other people defend protesters. And I will do neither. My judgments are reserved for, you know, after I've done the research and can say, here is why X happened. But I think, you know, one of the issues we have is everyone thinks they know the right answer. Everyone thinks that they're the center. Everyone is the center of their own universe. So they fight for what they want, what will benefit them. And if you happen to have, you know, police family or have been helped by police, you'll probably ignore the abuses. And if you haven't and you are a protester, you will focus on the abuses, as opposed to understanding that there are benefits and necessities to having the police force, as well as abuses that need to be held accountable.
You once told me how people from different sides can look at the same news article and have totally different readings of it. The bias isn't in the creator of the media. The bias is in the consumer of the media. It's on the consumer side instead.
Well, it's both. I mean, people will gravitate towards news that agrees with their worldview, and they'll move away from things that don't. And I think that's why we see so many viewers for Bill O'Reilly's show, for Rachel Maddow's show, for Jon Stewart. People want to hear things they agree with. You know, it's pretty much it. You get someone like Bill O'Reilly who rants about his political beliefs, and if they agree with him, it's a great thing. And if they disagree with him, he's horrible.
When you think about your viewers, do you think that they all come from one political leaning or the other?
They don't, and it's funny because I have, it's funny because they all seem to think I'm their political, you know, affiliation. I've had libertarians just assume that I was a libertarian because what I'm doing is good and it benefits everyone, so clearly I must be doing what they want because they have the right answer. And then when I tell them I don't necessarily know, I don't align really anywhere, they're, you know, baffled.
Do you vote?
That's a good question. I voted last time, but I don't know. It's I don't know if I will this year.
At this point, another live streamer walks over, Tim's friend Luke. Unlike Tim, Luke got a start in the scene through the 9/11 truth movement. And in a moment, I'm actually going to make the mistake of calling Occupy Wall Street over.
Security! Get this freak away from me. Here, hold on.
So you're a fan of Tim Pool?
Very much so. I dream about him. I fascinate him. I fascinate him about it all the time. Really? Oh, no comment.
Luke's well known for producing content on his own website, doing interviews, as well as covering the protest in a more produced fashion. And then I was streaming, and then I told Luke to start streaming, and Luke told me to start producing videos. And then it took me longer than it took him, but...
And then we both learned our mistakes, and we learned from each other.
Yeah, we absolutely.
What's it been like for you now that Occupy's ended?
It's still going. There's still, you know, there's still so many different things going on. There's still so many different issues. And as a journalist, you know, it's all about just telling people exactly what's happening and just showing them. So things of this nature will never end. There's always something to talk about. There's always something to uncover. There's always something to question. And there's always something to document. So it's been busy, just like it has been during Occupy.
Actually, what made you start with produced video, and how has it been different for you to move over to live?
I've been doing produced video since 2007. It really is a lot of work, and it's very time consuming. But it's very beneficial to be able to cut something down and to be able to show people exactly what's happening. When live came in, I mean, we started doing live back in 2008. 2007 and 2008, we started doing live streaming through our laptops. The technology was not yet there. And that's why I never had my faith in it. But I was always a huge proponent of it, because once you're live, people can't accuse you of editing down footage for your own personal bias. People can't accuse you of lying and being manipulative. It's exactly what you see. It's exactly what you go through. It's exactly what you hear. There is nothing fake about it. It's the real form of media. So I've always been a huge proponent of live streaming. I never knew the technology was there until recently. At the start of Occupy, it really started progressing. It really started developing really well. And it's always something that I always wanted to have, but never had faith in, because the technology was never there. Now it is there, and now it's not only amazing to be able to show everything live and unbiasedly, but it's also amazing to have that protection with you, where people are able to see in real time if something happens to you, and they're able to spread the information out to the entire world. So now if a police officer does anything stupid and tries to destroy, you know, arrest me or delete my footage, which has happened to me before, now the record's already up on there and nobody could deny it in a court of law, and the footage will never be destroyed.
It was a struggle, but through my direct mentorship and hours upon hours of training, I was finally able to get Luke live streaming, and it required some stiff reprimands and a few beatings.
So learning produced video, what were the challenges there?
I'm a bit more stubborn than that. Luke told me a long time ago to start moving towards produced video. I mean, one of the factors, I didn't have a camera or a way to get one that, you know, can be expensive. But I was a bit more stubborn and ignored it until I got more criticism from other people and decided that I should have listened to Luke a long time ago. Told me so. And work, you know, start working on more produced content. But, you know, we definitely have our differences in the produced contents. So far, the stuff I've put up has, I've done a few videos where they were direct, you know, I was directly filming the protests in Spain, and those got picked up pretty well. And then I've had a lot of success with doing sort of just essentially reporting. You know, the camera points it at me and I explain an issue. And whereas Luke's videos tend to be interviewing, you know, powerful individual celebrities and things, so we have our differences. So people say that, you know, Occupy is dead, but it's not dead, it's just not mainstream anymore. It's become like a subculture. You know, it's really funny how poorly covered I find everything to be. And when I was in Spain, I'm seeing, you know, all these reporters, and I'm hearing all this talk of austerity, and they're calling them anti-austerity protests, and I'm like, that is wrong. You can't... The protests in Spain, they refer to as anti-austerity, but they're protesting for so many different reasons. And I think if you ask them, they'll tell you democracy. That when it comes to the bailouts, when it comes to even austerity, when it comes to education and jobs, they're not listened to. These people are... They feel disenfranchised. And then you get the media who just calls it austerity protests, which is further, you know, it's furthering the problem.
So you guys both have little, I mean, not little, press badges.
Mine's bigger than his.
No, it's not.
Well, mine's fancier.
I got another one. I got three more in my bag.
I got two, and one's really big.
So where do they come from, and how do you use them?
I made mine. I designed it myself. It's printed on PVC. And it's got a barcode that works, scannable. It's got my information, contact information, and I wave it around. And it works.
I use different ones. I mean, yes, you could go to Kinko's and get some, you know, get your own press pass. Yes, you could go on different websites, get them as well. I also like wearing, some of the press passes I have were approved by police departments, like the Metropolitan Police Department of Washington, D.C. Some of them were approved by NATO and presidential debates. And those are also, you know, forms of accreditation, form of identification. But really, at the end of the day, all it is, and whether it's approved by police departments or the State Department, or rather you go to Kinko's, all it is a fancy piece of paper that's laminated and looks really nice with your picture on it and name on it.
Where can people find your work, Luke?
Primarily on youtube.com/wearechange, but the best way to find out what's going on with live streaming and videos and pictures is on twitter.com/LukeWeAreChange.
At this point in our conversation, the march begins down 14th Street, heading towards a basketball court on the Lower East Side. Tim tweets his followers, turns his camera horizontal, and goes live.
6:11 p.m., and it looks like the march here is kicking off. Crowd seems to be about 150 to 200 people. So this is an annual anti-police brutality march that happens. Well, I said it's annual already. So this happens every year. We got Mr. Lou Bradasco over here, but he's not streaming.
Towards the end of our march, Tim comes over to me and says he wants to go to Beirut next.
Why?
I was talking to another veteran journalist who mentioned lending me body armor. I'm well aware that my experience might not be at that level where I'm going to go into an actual conflict region. So I'm just working on getting experience. You know, Madrid was a scale up, and Greece is a strong possibility to just, you know, wherever it's needed, wherever it's interesting, and I'm trying to build the experience to where I can eventually go into, you know, particularly more dangerous regions.
You're saying that the anti-police brutality march tonight wasn't that dangerous?
No. This is a very calm and peaceful expression of angst from a community over police brutality. I don't think we're going to see any violence. I think it's a protest, and it's very orderly.
So we'll see where Tim ends up next. And for more information about him and his work, head over to the Free Music Archive. We have an interview with him where he'll show you how to make your own streaming video. And where can people learn more about your work?
You can find me on Twitter. My handle is @TimCast. And you can also check out my YouTube page, which is youtube.com/TimCasts, TimCasts.
Thanks so much for talking with me today, Tim.
No problem.
And you can see a video of Tim Poole explaining how to set up your own live stream on the Free Music Archive. Just visit freemusicarchive.org. For Radio Free Culture, I'm Andrea Salenzi. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back the last Monday of the month. Stay tuned for Nardwar, the Human Serviette radio show, here on WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, and WFMU.org.
and you're listening to WFMU. And it's time right now for the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. Today in the Nardwuar to Human Serviette Radio Show, an interview from the 90s. Yes, let's go back to August 8th, 1997, to my interview with Isaac Brock of Modest Mouse. Modest Mouse from Issaquah, Washington, home of the Regal Select record label, and one of the best bands ever on the Regal Select record label was the Fallouts from Seattle, Washington. Here's the Fallouts with Jealous Kind on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show on WFMU. You?
This is Isaac.
From the band Modest Mouse.
From the band Modest Mouse.
No, Isaac, sorry for fading out your song Summer there.
Oh, that's alright. That's alright, you know.
It is a very funky summer tune, isn't it?
Yeah, it was designed so that anyone who wanted action, you know, like, I mean, you just put that on, and Nardwar Instant Action.
And you're phoning live from Everett, Washington.
Yeah, the most beautiful town in all of Washington.
Where
to own a car lot, you know?
Where it is very, very sunny there today. And so, is it sunny there today?
It's damn sunny, and the traffic is nice, you know? Like, we were lounging in the traffic.
You're really enjoying that, aren't you, Isaac?
Oh, it's great. We just stopped by some fast food restaurants, plural. I decided I'd go for two of them. So I got a little something at Jack in the Box here and a little something at Taco Bell, you know, to see how they play against each other and play with each other.
The ultimate cheeseburger from Jack in the Box, perhaps?
No, it was some sort of chickeny thing. It wasn't very ultimate, though. It's crispy, spicy chicken.
Well, Isaac, tell me, who else is in Modest Mouse? Who else is in Modest Mouse?
Oh, Eric and Jeremy. Do you want last names?
Oh, sure. Names and ages always helps.
Okay. Eric Judy is 23 years old. No, 22. Something like that. And then he's on the bass. And then on the drums, you got Jeremiah Green, who is 20 years old. 21, no wait, oh, Vancouver, it doesn't matter, 20 years old. I was going to lie in case, you know,
that's
got to be 21 to
That's
play
very diplomatic
here.
Of you, that's very media conscious, Isaac, and you, of course, are Isaac Brock.
I am.
Now, yeah. Isaac Brock, who won the War of 1812?
I think that the Spanish won.
The War of 1812 between Canada and the USA.
Yeah, the Spanish won.
Yeah, the war.
Anything to do with it.
Well, yes, you did. Who really is Isaac Brock, Isaac Brock? Come on. Who is Isaac Brock, Isaac Brock?
Isaac Brock, Isaac Brock?
Yeah, who is Isaac Brock?
Oh, he's some Canadian guy.
Yes, he is.
I had a silver dollar.
Yes, he is.
Sir Isaac Brock on it.
Sir Isaac Brock, your name is Isaac Brock. You play in the band Modest Mouse, but Isaac Brock was a British general who was killed in the War of 1812 in the Battle of Queenston Heights.
And they still gave him a dollar.
And it was the Canadians versus the Americans. Actually, the British versus the Americans. And he repulsed. Isaac Brock repulsed the American troops, but he died in the battle.
Oh, man, but, you know, the Spanish still won that war.
Unfortunately, there was no Spanish to be found in that area.
Exactly.
Maybe a bit south there. But Isaac, what I was curious about, Isaac Brock, the Canadian general, the British general that died in the Battle of Queenston Heights, his descendants all have red hair.
Do they?
Do you have red hair?
I grow a red beard. I've got, like, black hair.
You really do have some red hair on you.
Yes.
Your private parts, your pubic hair is red.
Well, yeah, they can be kind of red, but they're mostly black, too, you know?
Because Isaac Brock, Sir Isaac Brock, all his descendants have red hair, and he was also born in the Isle of Guernsey in Channel Islands in Britain. Do you have any relatives in the Isle of Guernsey, Channel Island?
No, they're all Irish and Scottish.
And some of his relatives of Isaac Brock are actually coming to Vancouver this fall for a big celebration.
Am I invited?
I wonder if you are. Maybe you should check it out, Isaac Brock. And you are Isaac Brock of Modest Mouse. And, of course,